It's a great honor to introduce Dr. Cindy Parker to you. We've been talking Cindy up for a number of weeks now. Cindy lives in Philadelphia. She is an Old Testament scholar, and we got to know Cindy in Israel about 5 or 6 years ago, and then she was our teacher again just this last year in June when a group of us went. Cindy has a very special gift to make the Bible come alive by paying attention to things like the terra firma, the ground, geography, food, agriculture, the social, political environment in which the Bible was written. She did her PhD in place in Deuteronomy, and as we've gotten to know Cindy, she loves talking about Deuteronomy.
It's true.
And not just because it's the most quoted book in the New Testament. There are other reasons why, too. And she's not even speaking on Deuteronomy today, but this coming Saturday at the breakfast, you'll get some Deuteronomy. We have just grown to love Cindy so much. She's such a real, genuine, fun person, and we are so happy that we get to introduce her to you this morning. Let's welcome Cindy as she speaks.
Thank you. Thank you. It is really fun to be here. Members of your congregation have been with me in a displaced area, you know, out in the Middle East, and it's just really fun to be able to come and see where you reside normally, and what your congregation and what your body is like, and the ways you are working together to influence your community is such a beautiful thing for me to see. So it really is a pleasure for me to be here with you over the next few days, next two Sundays anyway. I would like to start with a story, if that's okay. It's going to be a story about me. And what I would like for you to do is we're going to engage our imaginations a little bit. So I'm going to tell you this story, and then we're going to pretend that you're going back to your growth groups this week to discuss the story. So here's the story. It's a true story. I'm not making it up. It is a true story. When I was working on my master's degree, a friend of mine convinced me that I should go to Kakuma with her over the summer. And so we went, we spent several weeks, 5 or 6 weeks, I think, we were at Kakuma. It was really quite an amazing experience. Kakuma is a really small town, really small little area, and then there's a larger section of people that live very close to Kakuma. And so we were there to teach. Now, I wasn't super interested in the things I was told I was allowed to teach, so I didn't have this innate passion for the information I was teaching, but I was really fascinated with the experience, with the community. So while we were in Kakuma, we had really interesting modes of transportation. We would sit on the back padded seat on the back end of a bicycle, and these young men would, you know, pedal us wherever we needed to go. Slightly disconcerting sometimes after lunch when they would say, "You've eaten too much." We're like, "Oh, I don't feel good about myself in this moment," right? But so I spent quite a while teaching in Kakuma, and because I wasn't super interested in the things that I was teaching, I had this internal feeling of, what am I doing here? Does this matter? Is this making a difference? Who really cares about this? Is it silly of me to have given up my summer in order to do this? And in fact, those questions bugged me until I did my PhD work. When I was doing my PhD work, one day, I happened to meet Ellen Davis, and in the course of this conversation with Ellen Davis, she said that she was starting a school, and in the school were students that had learned in Kakuma. So that's the end of the story. For just a moment, I know it feels awkward, but we're gonna get there. And so pretend this week, Tuesday, Wednesday, Friday, whatever, you're getting together with your growth groups and you're hashing the story. and you're kind of going, what did that story mean? What was she trying to get at by telling us this story? All of us can't help but bring our own narrative and our own context to the story. Right? So we're going to interpret the story based on what we know in our own lives. And so let's say in your growth group, you have a lot of people who are teachers. The teachers are going to go, you know what? What this means is we really should focus on teaching the things we're passionate about. Like when we're not leaning into our strengths, it feels awkward. Right? So there's something like, you know, the teachers are going to see the teaching aspect of what I was doing and pull something out of that. Maybe there's people in your growth group and you're just really concerned about the environment. And so you might go, you know what? You know what I got out of that story? There's a really great green energy that we haven't quite harvested yet in our community, because maybe we have a lot of teenagers who are looking for jobs and need to learn business skills, and they should put big padded seats on the back of their bicycles, right? There's like no emission. It keeps the teenagers busy. They learn business skills. It's good green energy. Maybe some of you who are in advertising or pay attention to women's rights might go, we really have issues with the way women see their bodies. Like this body shaming thing, we really need to stop that. Like stop mentioning how whatever they ate at lunch is affecting how difficult it is to transport them around. Right? So do you see how kind of based on your own context, you're going to read into the story that I told you? What if instead you spent time in your growth groups asking questions of the story? Can we get at the background? Can we get at what this means? Like, can we dig before we interpret? Right? Okay, so if we were to dig, how about if you were to say, how much time was there between when Cindy did her MA work and her PhD work? It was 7 years between those degrees, which is interesting because now you know for 7 years, this event really bothered me. That's a long time. Do you know where Kakuma is? Yeah. Oh, I actually see a couple of people going, yes. That is not normal. Most people have no clue where Kakuma is. Kakuma is in northern Kenya. And Kakuma is home to one of the largest UN refugee camps. So when we were in Kakuma, we were actually at the refugee camp and we were working with Sudanese. And this was right after the massive genocides that were going on in South Sudan. So that kind of changes a few things. Ellen Davis, do you know who she is? Your sermon series is Wondrous Depths, which comes from Ellen Davis. She is my hero. She's an Old Testament professor who is so crazy brilliant. When I did meet her, like I kind of jumped in front of her and stuck out my hand and totally embarrassed myself. And I'm sure she thought that was weird. But I was just like, I was meeting my hero, right? And I was just so excited about meeting her. And where is the school that she is starting? She teaches at Duke University, but she is starting a Bible college in the newly minted country of South Sudan. So when she said, all of my students learned in Kakuma, doesn't this change things? All of those details were in the very first story I told you, but now that we've kind of asked questions and pulled out the background of this story, suddenly the weight of the story is different because for 7 years I pondered why on earth I was doing this thing. Did God care? Did it even matter? And then 7 years later, God used my greatest wonderful hero to let me know that all of the new Bible leaders in South Sudan learned in Kakuma. That's just kind of a richer and deeper way to interpret the story that I told. There's something about when we read scripture and read the Bible, if we, instead of just instinctually bringing our immediate interpretation to the text, if we ask questions of the text first to get at what the background really is all about, there's something so richly rewarding about that. And so I want to practice that with you today with the book of Ruth. Ruth tends to be a very well-known, well-loved story, so I imagine a lot of you are probably familiar with the book of Ruth, but let's see if we can't just pull out a few new details about the text. So we're going to look at land and culture first, because I am a big picture kind of person. You know, I'm the personality type that needs to understand the frame and what the overall canvas is like before I can get in and really look at brushstrokes. So for those of you who are the detail people, we need all the little details, and then the details make the big picture. I'm sorry. Another sermon I'm sure will work for you. But we're going to do land and culture. We're going to look at what this actually means. So we're asking questions of the text first before we actually get into a very well-known and well-loved story. I love the fact that I can put a map up on the screen on a Sunday and have great confidence that you don't think that's weird, because I know Brian teaches you. And it's very exciting to me. I'm a map person. I orient everyone to maps first, which throws a lot of people off, but I'm very happy to know that this congregation is accustomed to this. So everything in the book of Ruth has to do with the area that's in the circle on the map. So you can see the area of the Dead Sea down towards the bottom of the map. So the hills of Judah basically are the hills that have the circle drawn around them. So we're looking at hill country land. And hill country land has a certain effect on people. We tend to keep communities quite small and quite conservative because they're not on the big highways. And so they're not experiencing lots of traffic and international culture and goods that are coming through. So it's quite a conservative type of an area. So we know that just by knowing where the hills of Judah are. So let's zoom in on the circle. If we were to zoom in, we would see more details of the hills that would look like this. Over on the left-hand side of the map, you see the red line. The red line that's kind of snaking its way through the dark brown hills of Judah is the local highway. It is the spine of the hill country. So when you come from this direction, from the west towards the spine of the hills, that area gets quite a lot of rain, and it's very consistently very good farming territory. When you get to the other side of the red line, everything over here to the east towards the Dead Sea ends up being really dry. So because of the way that the clouds work, there's a rain shadow effect. So wet on this side, dry on this side, and you see the circle there. The circle is around Bethlehem. So Bethlehem sits very close, practically exactly on that highway. So even just looking at the map, we know people in Bethlehem, hills of Judah, small conservative area, like we have that part down, and kind of this mixture of wet area, which is going to be farming territory, and dry area, which will be shepherding territory. So in the area of Bethlehem, actually right outside Bethlehem, I took this picture. So this is almost exactly right on the patriarchal highway, so right on the spine of the hill country. And you can see how the residents there have kind of terraced off a little bit of the hills. You see greenery that is evident because there's enough water there for them to grow crops. But basically, if we were to stand there and then turn and face east, and then maybe walk 3/4 of a mile, maybe a kilometer, I should say. I'm up here in Canada. So a kilometer away, we would end up looking at shepherding territory. So there's greenery in this picture, but there's not very much. And then if you go maybe another kilometer, more like maybe another 2 or 3 kilometers away, you end up with land that looks like that. So you can see how in the forefront of this picture, in the foreground, there's a house there, so there's the ability to live there. You can see how the land has been turned over, and so there's brown soil. So there's something about the soil. It seems to be able to produce crops. But just beyond where that house is, everything is so dry and it's barren, and you get this moonscape look, and then you're in shepherding territory. When you live in Bethlehem, you live with a wide open spread from farming territory to shepherding territory. There's no geographical anything that is going to block the effects of the wilderness from stepping over the dryness of the wilderness and just kind of slaughtering you with famine, right? It takes very little for the effects of the wilderness to hit the people who are in Bethlehem. And so we find people who live in the Bethlehem area end up diversifying because diversifying your assets can be really good. And especially when you live during an ancient time, you don't want to put everything into farming because it's not going to take much for the shepherding wilderness to invade your land. And so you might keep a couple sheep on the side just in case we have a year where we don't get very much rain. Do you notice in the far back part of the picture, do you notice how there's a real faint line? Do you see it's right where I say the hills of Moab and there's an arrow pointing down? I don't know if you could, it might seem a little washed out to you, but there's a real faint line over there. In the far eastern side, so over the top of the Rift Valley, the hills of Moab are more elevated than the hills of Judah. What that means is if you're standing in Bethlehem, and if you're looking to the east and everything is seeming quite dry, when you look out towards the hills of Moab with more elevation, they have probably been able to get more rain out of the clouds. And so there is likely more water in Moab than there is over in the hills of Judah. And you can physically see it from the area of Bethlehem. Right, so sometimes areas of Bethlehem, the hills of Judah, experience a drought, but the hills of Moab don't experience the drought. Okay, so this is our physical context of where our narrative is going to take place. So let's look at the cultural context of where this, how this is embedded in our story. So in the ancient Near East, for the ancient Israelites, everything is about family. You are most loyal to your family, then maybe the rest of the people in your clan, then maybe the people in your tribe. Maybe at some point in time you might think more nation, all of the Israelites. But at the core of what you care about is your family, right? So your family is everything. Everything depends on preserving your family land and your family lineage so that you have children to maintain that land, right? So your land is the way you pass family wealth from generation to generation, but then you need people to work that land. So there's a lot of rules, kind of unspoken cultural rules, and it's all about preserving the land and preserving the family. So we end up with a patriarchal society, which I'm not saying is a good thing. In fact, I would very much argue it's a really bad thing. And I would say for us in modern day, we should feel welcome to critique the patriarchal society. But it is what it was, and it worked for them then. Right? And so there's something about understanding what was the most important in a patriarchal family. So for patriarchs, the role in the family is determined by the male line. So the father of the family, it is his job to protect the family honor. He is the public face of the entire family. And so he is going to do public contracts. He's going to do negotiation for goods. He is working with the elders. He will work with traders who are coming and going. So he is the public face of everything. The mom is the internal household manager, and she has a really tough job because she's going to have a very finite amount of wheat, a finite amount of oil, and she has to manage that for the entire year to make sure that her family can survive. She is also the household educator, so she is the first one to teach the children their own culture, how do you act in society, their own songs of worship, their own background stories. So she is the educator and the manager. Father is the public face. The kids then support the family. And in the family household, you probably have an older generation living with you as well. So the grandparents are in your house, and then you have the father and the mother and the kids. If you are a woman in a patriarchal society, everything about who you are is defined by the men in your life. You are the wife of so-and-so, or you are the mother of so-and-so, right? You are the caretaker of these people. So your roles all depend on the men, which doesn't, I know, seem fair, but again, we'll critique later. We're setting up the background for this particular story. Within this patriarchal society, since so many things depend on the men and the male line, there actually is a little bit of grace that is woven into Israelite law to help protect those who don't fall under the cultural norm. So what do you do with the widows who don't have a husband, who don't have that family umbrella? What do you do with them? What do you do with orphans who don't have parents? What do you do with foreigners who are coming in, who are among you, who don't have family and land in your midst? Like, what do you do with them? Right, so now here's where we have a concept called the Goel. The Goel is translated in a few different ways, but the Goel is the kinsman redeemer. So the Goel is a male person in your family somewhere who knows how many generations you have to go out. But it is someone else in your extended family who says, I will bring you, who are outside the umbrella, the social umbrella, I will bring you into my household. Right, I will bring you under my wings is one of the ways it's often talked about. So I will redeem you, bring you in, and now you fit again in this family structure that we as a society understand a little bit better. So the Goel is the kinsman redeemer. He will restore the household. So one of his jobs, which seems a little bit weird for us, I know, so this is a little cringeworthy, but if you are a young woman, you are married to a man who dies, maybe in battle or something. So he dies and you don't have any kids. So now you don't have a husband and you don't have kids to support you. The Goel, part of his job is then to marry this widow and to sleep with her so that she can have children again. But then the Goel's job is done. And now she has kids who can take care of her. She maintains the family property, and her kids get the property of her first husband. So the Goel is there just to help her family line continue and flourish. Now let's get to the story of Ruth. And let's bring a little bit about what we've learned into this story. So read along with me. We're going to skip through all four chapters of the book of Ruth. We're going to start with the very first verse because nothing is throwaway text in this book. Everything is here for a purpose. So we're going to look at Ruth chapter 1, verse 1. So Ruth chapter 1, verse 1 says, now, it came about in the days when the judges governed. Pause. That phrase is loaded context. What does it mean? What was going on in the days when the judges governed? Well, that refers to the book prior to this one in the way that we've organized our Bible. And what do we see in the book of Judges? We see an Israelite society that was healthy and whole in the beginning. And through the courses of the judges governing, society falls apart. How do we know society was falling apart? One way you can always tell in ancient society when everything is going awry is how they treat their women. And if you go through the book of Judges, just looking at how the women are treated, we go from Deborah, judge, to Samson, sleeping with different women. Women are kind of, they come and go, and they're toss-away characters. Right, so, and then we get even beyond there, and we have a Levite who actually cuts his concubine into 12 pieces. You know the story? It's weird. It's often not preached because that's a hard one. There's got to be an application somewhere. I'm not sure what it is, right? But okay, so this is what the author is telling us. This is during the time of the judges. Society is falling apart. The entire book of Judges is setting us up to look for a king. We need a strong leader. We need someone who can pull society back together again, who can take all of these 12 tribes that are scattered in this land and make them cohesive and make them fit under one kind of government. Right? So that's what the entire book of Judges is telling us. And so when the book of Ruth opens up, this happens during that time. So basically, we already know society is messed up and people are not acting the way that God really wants them to act to reflect his character in society. It's going to take us a long time to get through the book of Ruth. No, just kidding. I'll go faster. Okay. It says there was a family in the land, or there was a famine in the land. And a certain man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn in the land of Moab with his wife and two sons. So already we're like, oh, the story has a little bit more depth because we know this family is from Bethlehem. We go, oh, right. Bethlehem is going to be one of the first communities to feel the effect of a famine because that wilderness has overstepped the bounds into the city. They can't survive. But remember that picture on the horizon line of Bethlehem? You can see the higher hills of Moab. And there's something about looking out over there. Somehow Moab looks like it's getting water. Moab has a very similar type of cultural context that the Israelite hills of Judah had. So we don't have water. They seem to have water. We have very similar lifestyles. Let's go there. Okay. Verse 2. The name of the man was Elimelech, which is a godly name. So we have this, he's a man of God. And the name of his wife, Naomi, which is a word that means darling. Like, aw, like she's the darling. It's so sweet, right? Naomi. And the names of his two sons were Mahlon, Sickly, and Kilion, about to die. Like terminal patient. It means someone who's like on a terminal deathbed sentence. So we kind of don't have a whole lot of hope for these two guys. Now they entered the land of Moab and remained there. Then Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her two sons. They took for themselves Moabite women as wives. The name of one was Orpah, and the name of the other Ruth. And they lived there about 10 years. And then, here's the shocker, it was like spoiler alert that we got in verse 2, the boys die. We all kind of knew that was going to happen because they're sickly and terminal. Okay, now what does all of this tell us, right? Like already, we should be on the edges of our seats as the readers of this text because in these first couple verses, everything's gone wrong. The land isn't supporting the people, right? That's a problem. In this whole patriarchal society that exists, Naomi now has no cultural, social umbrella. She has no husband, and her kids died, before having children. She has nothing. And now she's a foreigner in a foreign place, and no one is going to take care of her. What does Naomi do? The only thing she possibly can do is say, I'm going back to Bethlehem. Maybe there's a Goel in Bethlehem, but she's an older woman. And so what is the hope of there being a Goel that's like, yeah, I'll marry you, right? Like, not going to happen. So there's something very tenuous about her own situation. And we should be feeling this anxiety. What is she going to do? Not only that, but she now has two daughters-in-law. What are they going to do? Because they're in the same situation. They have left their father's house. They have married. Their husbands have died. They have no kids. So her daughters-in-law are in the exact same position that she is in. And it's kind of, let's have a meeting of the minds. And what do we do? We're on the outskirts of society. And Naomi says, the only thing I possibly can do is go home. Daughters, you should go back to your father. Your fathers can maybe find you another husband. You still have hope if you return to your household. And Orpah goes, okay, you're right. That is really the only practical thing to do. Ruth is the one who says the very culturally obscure and very strange thing. Because Ruth says later in chapter 1, her very famous saying, but you have to pay attention to how bizarre this is. So I'm in chapter 1, and in verse 16, it says, but Ruth said, do not urge me to leave you or turn back from following you, for where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, your God, my God. Okay, think just for a moment, what is the choice Ruth is making? Ruth is saying, I could go back to my dad, get married, and have kids, and fit within society in a very normal, practical, secure way. I'm going to choose to go with the most vulnerable person in my life, my mother-in-law, to a foreign land. So in a society in which your bloodline means everything, your family land, your family inheritance is the thing that controls your society, Ruth is saying, I give all of it up and I'll go with you. Ruth is taking this very dramatic, vulnerable position to say, I now am landless, peopleless, and godless. And so if I go now with Naomi, being drawn into society is going to depend on the people of Bethlehem saying, we accept you into our community and in our midst. We will accept you as one of ours. Family, maybe. Tribe or clan, maybe. Tribe, yeah, maybe Bethlehem will say, this tribe of Judah will take care of you. Maybe, but it's a vulnerable position. Right? This isn't a throwaway sentence or a throwaway thing that Ruth has. So there's another term, another concept within the Hebrew Bible through the Old Testament. It shows up quite a bit. It's called chesed. And to really embody the word, you really have to get that guttural thing going. Chesed. What is chesed? In English translations, we often call it loving kindness, which is crystal clear, right, to everyone? Loving kindness. I don't even know what that is. I'm not exactly sure what that's supposed to connote to us. We don't use that term. It's such a weird term, but it's in the Bible, so it's sacred. Chesed, loving kindness, is really rich. There's no English equivalent to this word. It is actually a covenantal word. So it has a covenantal connotation to it. So something that is a deep, rich connection of people. And it means ever faithful. It means almost dramatically loyal. It means showing up when someone else can't repay you for anything. God is always chesed because God is always that deeply faithful to the point of sacrificial faithfulness, even if the other party to the chesed doesn't return that loyalty. So chesed, boy, it is this deep, rich, like you have to feel it in your gut kind of character, and God throughout the entire Bible is hesed. It is used of him all the time because God always shows up. God always cares for people on the perimeter. God always sweeps people in. God is always faithful to his covenant, even when his people reject him. Now, hesed. Some people are called hesed. And Ruth, after she says, I'm going to leave everything behind, I'm going with the most vulnerable person in my life, and I'm going to make myself even more vulnerable than I am right now. Ruth is hesed, because Ruth is that kind of giving sacrificial love to her mother-in-law into a foreign land and a foreign people. And there is one person who notices, Boaz. Right? That was in the scripture that we read right before I'm speaking. Boaz, he came and he saw her and he's like, who is this? And they're like, ah, she's the one who came back with Naomi. She's the one who told Naomi, hey, don't worry, I will go out and work the ground. I will go out and very visibly as someone who doesn't belong, I'll harvest the edges of the field, which is basically self-identifying that I don't own anything, that I am part of the poor of society, but I'm gonna work the edges of the field. And Boaz goes, whoa, wow. And there is something about the way that Ruth acts, the way that Ruth reflects God's character of hesed into an Israelite community. She, as a Moabite woman, reflecting that back to them as to the character their God is, that Boaz goes, that is remarkable. Come and stay. Let's take care of you. Right? You have to be one of the not only are you one of the vulnerable, but you're one of the vulnerable who is reflecting God's character. Let's keep you around. Right? So then we end up a little bit later. Naomi finds out that Boaz is now in the picture and that Boaz is being generous with Ruth. And Naomi goes, oh, Boaz is a potential Goel. Boaz is a distant family relative of ours. Let's see if we can remind him of that and see if we can get him to take up his mantle of leadership and actually provide for us very officially and bring us back into the center of society. So Naomi tells Ruth, this is in chapter 3. So Boaz is going to be out at the threshing floor. I think I actually have a couple pictures of this. Here we go. This is a threshing floor. There's nothing fancy about it. It's basically just a slab of bedrock that is cleared. So people at the end of the harvest season, so you do it with barley and you do it with your wheat as well. So we know this is the wheat season. Everything is, Ruth is harvesting at the edges of Boaz's wheat fields. So Boaz is going to take his entire family fortune, right, that has just grown, and he's going to take it to the threshing floor. Threshing floors are used communally, so it's a really large space. Boaz would have a little corner of the threshing floor. So you can see on the picture the thing that looks like a sled, that really long wooden board is the threshing sledge. So you use that, you turn it, spin it in circles, usually a donkey will pull it around, and it chops up all of the wheat, all of the grain. You then take the winnowing fork, and about 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, almost like clockwork, it's super reliable, the wind comes in from the west. And so as soon as the wind comes in the afternoon, you take your winnowing fork, and you just go into this chopped up wheat that is on the ground, and you toss it into the air. So the wheat kernels will fall down to the ground. And then all the straw-like chaff, the wind is going to carry it away off the threshing floor. So this is going to be the scene for the next part of our drama. So this would be someone who is pretending to be an ancient Israelite threshing the wheat that is on the threshing floor. And so Naomi says to Ruth, I know Boaz is going to be down there at the threshing floor. And when the wheat harvest comes in, that's the first signal of how successful the economy is going to be that year, because wheat and barley are the first crops that are harvested. So you can kind of tell, oh, it's going to be a bad year, or oh, it's going to be a great year. So this time of year is when a lot of people renegotiate contracts. So the farming families and the shepherding families will say, hey, for the next year, if you protect our eastern edge, we'll give you this much grain. Shepherds would say, when you're done with your fields, we would like to graze our sheep in your field. So there's all these very particular contracts that are made. So Naomi is saying, this is the season of contract making. Boaz is going to be at the threshing floor. Ruth, go make a new contract with Boaz. Right? Go out and find him there. And so Ruth is going to go out to the threshing floor. So I'm going to start from chapter 3, verse 8. And it says, it happened in the middle of the night that the man was startled and bent forward, and behold, a woman was lying at his feet. And in the Hebrew, there's a little going on, but it's all like super like sacredly portrayed in a very non-offensive way. But it is kind of this little, it's a scene filled with a lot of tension. It's going on, and Boaz is going, who are you? Right? So in verse 9, he said, who are you? And she answered, I am Ruth, your maid. So spread your covering over your maid. Your translation might say something else, because it's actually a spread your cloak or spread your wings. The edges of the cloaks were considered the wings of the garment. So spread your wings around me. Remember the Goel? He is the one who spreads the wings and brings in those on the perimeter back into society. So in this request, she's saying, I am known to you. I am Ruth. Remember, Hesed to Naomi. Spread your wings around me. Boaz knows exactly what it is that she is asking. So he says, hang out here. Make sure you're gone before all the other men wake up, just so that we don't create a stir. Right? I'm going to give you an exorbitant amount of wheat. In fact, the term that is given in the Bible is it's basically like 6 months' wages. Like he gives, it's an exaggerated number of like pounds of wheat that he is giving to her. And then she goes back to Naomi and basically says, I think we're in. Right? I'm pretty sure this is going to work. Now, Boaz still needs to make sure that this is an official contract, right? Because the women don't have the contractual power, right? So it has to be the males that are doing the honor of the family, right? All of the contracts for the family, that's the male job. So now Boaz has to take the initiative to figure out if he can actually be the Goel. And so in chapter 4, we now find Boaz, and he goes to the city gate. So the picture that I have up on the screen is a picture of a city gate. Now, granted, this is a city gate that is several, maybe like 100 years, 150 years after the placement of this story. 200 years, actually. So it's a significantly more modern gate than anything that would have been in Bethlehem. But it's a good picture for what the gate was. So all of these, once you go from a village to a slightly larger town and you're walling in your town, you need a gate so that you can go in and out. There's only one gate to a city, right? Because it's the opening to your wall. It's a place of vulnerability. So there's only one. Everyone passes through the gate. Right, so all of the farmers who are living inside the city have to go out to their farms during the daytime, right? So everyone's going to pass. If you have sheep in your family, you might keep your sheep in your house in the city where they're protected, but you're going to take them out of the city to graze. So everyone comes in and out through the city gates every single day. So the gate ends up being the heart of the community. Everything happens there. And if you look at a lot of the Hebrew Bible text, it'll say there are people who are buying and selling. So extra flour, extra grain, extra olive oil. They're going to, this. It's like the impromptu pop-up marketplace, right? Because you're going to catch the greatest flow of people at the city gates. And so that's where you're going to set up your little stall. So people buy and sell at the city gates. Therefore, those who are on the perimeter of society are going to beg for alms at the city gate because, you know, again, high traffic flow. Someone's going to take pity on you. There are also judgments. So if you have complaints against your neighbor, the elder of the city will be at the city gate. You and your neighbor bring your complaint to the elder, and then judgment is made in the city gates very publicly so that everyone knows the resolution of the problem. So everything happens at the city gate. And so Boaz finds out there actually is another person in Naomi's family who should be stepping up into the Goel position. And Boaz knows, in order for me to go find that person, I should go to the city gates. And so he sits in the city gate and he waits for this other family member to come passing through the gate. So when he finds him, he then says, okay, we need to do a new contract. 'Tis the season for contracts anyway. We need a business agreement. We need witnesses for this. And so we're going to wait for 10 more elders of the city to come passing through. And we're going to step aside into a smaller chamber of the gate. So he probably was finding these people in the big open area of the gate. But then there's smaller, more private areas, and they can pull off to the side. And so in chapter 4, Boaz tells this relative, you are the next in line to be Goel, and that means you should receive Naomi's family property. And this relative goes, yeah, well, sure, I'd love to. Like, I'll take more property, wrap it into my own family fortune. I'd be happy to do that. What agreement do we need to make? And Boaz goes, oh, by the way, that agreement comes with Naomi and Ruth. And we see in chapter 4 that this other relative pauses. Now, this should make sense to us, right? Because Naomi, not so much a problem to provide for a widow in the house. She's an older woman. But Ruth is the problem because Ruth is of childbearing age. And so if this guy takes the position of Goel, and if he marries Ruth, Ruth will have children. Her children will get her husband's land. So in other words, the Goel puts himself out in order to raise up someone else's kids, and they get to keep all of that land. He doesn't get to have it. And we see this relative go, oh, wait, no. Because that means my family inheritance and what my economy and what how I'm trying to provide for my own kids is going to be in danger because of Ruth. I don't want it. And then Boaz goes, okay, I'm next, and I'm happy to take on that role. What is interesting is we know nothing about Boaz. We don't know if he has other kids. We seem to know maybe potentially he seems to be fairly wealthy. But that's all that we know about him. But you know what? Boaz is said to have acted with great chesed to Ruth. So now we have Ruth and her actions to Naomi that is displaying God's character to the Israelite community. And Boaz notices, Boaz sees, and Boaz in return acts with great chesed to Ruth. So then we end up with this really beautiful ending of the story. So in chapter 4, and I really love this verse, and this is also a throwaway verse we don't pay very much attention to. Well, I'll start in verse 11. So chapter 4, verse 11. All the people who were in the court and the elders said, "We are witnesses to this contract that's being made. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your home like Rachel and Leah." Okay, wait, isn't that so cool? Who are Rachel and Leah? They're the matriarchs of the Israelites. Who are they speaking about but a Moabite woman? May she come into your household and be like our greatest matriarchs. That's such a cool blessing. Both of whom built the house of Israel. And may you achieve wealth in Ephrathah and become famous in Bethlehem. Moreover, may your house be like the house of Perez. Do you know who Perez is? Oh, this is good. This is a really good sermon. Here, I'll keep going because this is a really good sermon for another time. The house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah. Judah, one of the sons of Jacob, right? So Judah, who's one of the oldest, who is one of the ones who spearheaded the tossing Joseph into a well and selling him into Egypt. Judah, like kind of a scoundrel. Tamar, the one everyone kind of says, she was a prostitute, but she really wasn't, which is why we need sermons about her, because she's amazing. Tamar, who held everyone to the social code and said, you have to become the Goel, and holds Judah to the system of Goel. And Judah says, you are the most righteous of all. Right? So, okay. And again, it's like super cool. Tamar, not a prostitute, but righteous. So moreover, may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah through the offspring which the Lord gives you by this young woman. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife, and he went in to her, and the Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. And the women said to Naomi, blessed is the Lord who has not left you without a redeemer today, and may his name become famous in Israel. May he also be to you a restorer of life and a sustainer of your old age, for your daughter-in-law who loves you and is better to you than seven sons has given birth to him. Right, so even now the people of the community are saying, not just to Ruth, may you be like one of our matriarchs, but to Naomi, who has been pushed out to the perimeter. And they all go, your daughter-in-law, what she did is better than any person in an entire patriarchal society could have done. That kind of chesed was so powerful. And look what's happening. And so may the God who is our overall Goel, right? May God actually be the restorer of all things through Ruth. So it's so incredible. It's like such this powerful, people are recognizing even this person who is on the outskirts of society is contributing something powerful and reflecting something powerful about who their God is back to them. And then we almost always stop reading. Because after that comes a genealogy and blah, 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 begets blah, 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 and like, you know, like that's, it's just tedious. And so we kind of love to stop there. Oh, Naomi's been restored. It's like a happy ending and everyone lives happily ever after. We cannot dismiss the genealogy because genealogies are the biblical author's way of telling you the exclamation point that is on the story. And so let us pause just for a second and say, well, what is a genealogy? Biblical writers, it's not just like this list of data that is super tedious. Every person is a capsule of a story. And so when the biblical writers name people in particular in the text, it's their shorthanded way. It's like a hyperlink to the entire story that that person is associated with. And so it's a really quick way to remind you of a really long story. So it's like you can find out amazing data in these genealogies. You can see a greater element of the story that the biblical writers are writing if you pay attention and if you actually do the research to figure out who these people are. So genealogies are super specific and intentional, and it's a shorthanded way of writing, and we find one at the end of Ruth, and we should ask ourselves why. Why is there a genealogy now at the end of Ruth? We have Boaz, he marries Ruth, Naomi's restored, happily ever after. That's great. This is when we have to remember, where did we start our story? Remember, this was the day of the judges. The overall context was, we really need a king. Society is falling apart. If we read into it a little bit, the way women are treated in society is falling apart and deteriorating. We need a strong leader. We need to pull ourselves together. We're not reflecting God's character to ourselves, much less to anyone else. We need a king. And then we get this great story of Hesed and Goel, and all of that culminates in the genealogy. The genealogy actually is the point of the whole entire story. And so we get to this genealogy, and in verse 18, it starts, "Now these are the generations of Perez. To Perez was born Hezron, and Hezron was born Ram, and to Ram, Aminadab, and to Aminadab," and this is why people like eyes cross, because we're like, blah, 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 "was born Nashon, and to Nashon, Salmon, and to Salmon was born Boaz." Oh, we know Boaz. Boaz was Goel. Boaz was Hesed. "And to Boaz, Obed. And to Obed, who is it? Jesse. And to Jesse, David." Aha! This is the point of the story, right? We started in the time of the judges. We need a king. And then the authors of Ruth are going, and guess what? Through Ruth, her Hesed. Through Boaz, his Hesed. So through these elements of people reflecting God in a society that is falling apart, guess what? Through their line, we get David. And then we rejoice and we sing and we're like, that's amazing. We love David. David is a good king. David is able to unite all of the tribes and to pull them all together. David is one with a heart after God. Right? And so the ending of the book of Ruth is actually this massive exclamation point with like fireworks and confetti, if you have like an iPhone and you send messages with confetti. That's what's going on here at the end of the book of Ruth. This is not missed by the New Testament authors who are Jewish. So they're writing with good Jewish storytelling capabilities. And so when Matthew is giving us the Advent story, Matthew starts with a genealogy, and it's crafted and it's shaped a little bit. It's multi-layered, it's complex, and Matthew uses a few different women. Tamar, because she's not a prostitute, she is more righteous than all, right? Tamar deserves to be in there. And Ruth. Ruth ends up being this Moabite woman, becomes the one through whom King David comes. And Matthew honors that because Matthew is telling his audience, guess what? The great king that society needs because society is falling apart, that great king doesn't mean just David. We need an even better king. And guess what? Through Ruth, we get not just David, but through Ruth, we get Jesus. And Jesus now is going to set up a kingdom in which the people on the perimeter are brought in. And Jesus spends all of his ministry saying, "I am the Goel. I am the full embodiment of Chesed, of God. I'm the true reflection of God's character into the world that is around me." And Matthew knows the book of Ruth. Matthew knows this story. And he's like, oh, you know what? You thought the exclamation point was at the end of the book of Ruth. Let me tell you where the real double exclamation point is. It comes later through the life and the story of Jesus. So beautiful, right? It's the same story we've always read. It's just when we ask questions of the text, it just starts to build out into something more dramatic because the decisions the people in this text made were countercultural. Countercultural the way God is countercultural, countercultural in a way that actually reflected God accurately into society. And God's going, yeah, these are the people I can use. And through them, I'm going to send my own son. Which then brings us to a great part in our service where we actually get to remind ourselves of what it is that Jesus did as the great king. To come and restore society, to pull our culture together, to bring us all in. And he goes, and through him, this sacrificial kind of king who is then going to restore life and restore people to community and restore us to the way that God has called us to be. And so in the next part of this, when we come to the table, it is Jesus we're celebrating, but we're celebrating the choices of all the people who came before, right? All the people in God's long story who were reflecting God all along to get to the exclamation point of Jesus who is willing to break his body open for his church. Thanks.